So you know the story of Yosef and the brothers and how they were driven to violence against him because he flaunted his own fortune, his own positive fortune. He was the most favorite of the sons, favored by their father, and he tended to flaunt it. He said that he had dreams in which all of his brothers would be bowing down to him, not literally, but he said that their sheaves would bow down to his sheaf, and then the stars and the moon would bow down to him. So they were going to kill him, and then they threw him in a pit, and then they sold him to some Midianites who brought him to Egypt. And from that depth of being almost killed and then sold as a slave, he rises to the head of the whole household. But then he has another misfortune with the wife of Potiphar, who kind of frames him because she's upset with him, and he gets cast in the dungeon. So he gets even lower now. Now he's in prison. But then in prison, he rises back up again, and he becomes the helper of the warden of the prison, and he's in charge of everything again. Then he has some success interpreting some dreams for some prisoners. And when the cupbearer gets out and goes back to the house of the Pharaoh, the palace, eventually the Pharaoh has it, like 2 years later, has a dream that he can't interpret. And the cupbearer remembers Yosef in the prison. And so Yosef is brought out to interpret the dream for Pharaoh, and he interprets correctly, and Pharaoh's very impressed, and there's going to be 7 years of famine, and then, seven years of plenty, and then 7 years of famine, and then Yosef is put in charge of all of Egypt, and he's only second to the Pharaoh. Eventually the famine comes, and all of Yosef's family, his brothers, who had done this horrible thing to him, come to Egypt, come to him and bow down to him, just like his dream said, in order to get food. He recognizes them, and he pretends that he doesn't recognize them. They don't know who he is. And so he plays a series of tricks on them to bring them to the brink of despair. And eventually, he convinces them that they have to bring their youngest brother, Binyamin, who is the only full brother of Yosef. Because Yosef and Binyamin are the sons of Rachel, who was one of the four wives of Yisrael. And Rachel died, and Yisrael, Yaakov, thought that Yosef died too, and Binyamin was the only one left from that branch of the family. So Yaakov definitely didn't want Binyamin to go travel to Egypt, lest something should happen to him. But Yosef pushes the suffering of you know, his brother and his father, and makes them take Binyamin down, otherwise they're not going to be able to get any more food. So finally they do. He plays another trick on them where it kind of frames Binyamin, makes it look like he stole his royal chalice, and he's going to all the brothers are brought to him, and he says he's going to take Binyamin as a slave. And of course he's just pretending. So then this parsha begins right at that point. And Yehuda, the fourth son, comes forward and pleads with Yosef and says, look, this is what happened. And he basically recalls the whole story that I just said, except from his point of view. And he doesn't admit his crime or anything. He just says, the other brother's gone, you know, said we think he's dead. And, you know, this will be so horrible for our father if Binyamin is taken, so please take me instead. And so then Yosef, at that point, he cannot restrain himself in the presence of all who stood before him. So he called out to remove everyone from before me. So everyone is rushed out of the room except for the brothers. And then he cried out in a loud voice. Egypt heard and Pharaoh's household heard. And Yosef said to his brothers, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him because they were left disconcerted before him. That seems like an understatement. Then Yosef said to his brothers, "Come close to me if you please." And they came close. And he said, "I am Yosef, your brother. It is me whom you sold into Egypt. And now, don't be distressed, and don't blame yourselves for having sold me here, because it was to be a provider that God sent me ahead of you. For this has been 2 of the years of hunger in the midst of the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. Thus, God has sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival in the land and to sustain you for a momentous deliverance. And now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me father to Pharaoh, master of his entire household, and ruler throughout the land of Egypt." And so on. So could you imagine, you know, going through what Yosef went through and then saying to those who did it to you, "Don't worry. It was all part of God's plan. And the way the story unfolds, it's true. It's serendipitous. If he hadn't been there, if he hadn't interpreted the dreams, maybe they all would have been dead. Maybe they all would have... No, Egypt would not have survived either. Wouldn't have survived the famine. So the story is unfolding in a way that's revealing that there's a reason for everything, that there's a divine intention behind everything. But then if we step back a little further and we say, well, wait a minute... But that's not happily ever after, right? Because then the Hebrews all come to Egypt and they're all happy, they have good land, they're eating, they're satisfied, but then they all become slaves, of course, they're all oppressed, right? Oh, but that actually is for the reason that they should have a great deliverance and be brought out to liberation, right? But that's so great, right? If you go in the story a little further, they have some minor victories, but eventually they get slaughtered by the Babylonians and the temple's destroyed, right? Hey, Elaine.
Please come
home. You know, Elaine, I didn't look in there, but you please, you're welcome to go in there and check it out. Sure. Sorry about that. So it's a little bit like the, if you go ahead in Jewish history, we can see a lot of ups and downs, obviously, right? So it's a little bit like the story that I heard as a Zen story, the farmer, the Chinese farmer. You know about this story?
This one?
The Chinese farmer story. You know it? You know this one?
Yeah.
Where Chinese farmer loses his horse. And so all the neighbors come and they say, "Oh, how terrible, you lost your horse." And he says, "Maybe good, maybe bad, who knows?" And then the horse comes back with a bunch of wild horses, and the farmer becomes rich with all these horses, and everyone comes and congratulates him. "So wonderful, now you have all these horses." And he says, "Maybe good, maybe bad." His son goes and tries to break in the horses and breaks his leg trying to tame one of the horses. So all the neighbors come to console him. "So horrible, your son has broken his leg, now he can't work on your farm." "Maybe good, maybe bad." The next day, the army comes, trying to draft all of the young men. He can't go, his leg is broken. He gets saved from having to go in the army. And they all come and they say, "How wonderful that he broke his leg. Maybe good, maybe bad." So
he spoke with the Yiddish accent.
That's right.
He Buddhist, spoke like yeah.
This. Yeah. Maybe good, maybe bad. Who knows? Who knows? They can't both be right. You are also right. So this is the way that our mind wants to drag us. You know, like the neighbors that come. They want to be able to put a label on things and frame it as good or bad. And then, once we do that, then we get dragged around. And sometimes if we're not sure if something is good or bad, then it can give this disconcerting kind of feeling. I don't know whether to be happy about this or sad about this. I don't know whether to, as if that was a bad thing, as if as if somehow our security depended on knowing how to judge things, how to feel about things. But the Chinese farmer who says maybe good, maybe bad, or the Torah, that actually if you look at it as a totality, is not giving the light at the end of the tunnel. It's not giving the prize. You know, it's just moving forward in the drama of life, in the flow of life, and success and failure and so on. And in the Jewish understanding of time, the ultimate redemption, the ultimate goodness is sort of just projected in the ultimate future, you know, the Mashiach, when the Messiah comes. You know, that will be the time when everything is redeemed and everything is good. But that belief in this future time in which all is good really just functions to release, if you really believe that, it releases you from being dragged around by the ups and downs of life. Because you know, in the end, don't worry, in the end, it's all going to work out okay. Well, the belief is that it will. But if we look at how the belief functions for those who accept that belief, I'm not saying that therefore you should accept this belief. I'm just saying that the Torah itself doesn't give a rosy ending. The Torah itself has a completely ambiguous ending. And then the Bible, the rest of the Bible, also doesn't give a rosy ending. But in Rabbinic Judaism, they've developed this belief, which is probably much more ancient than that, that eventually everything will work out. Everything will be good eventually in the future. And that belief itself functions to free the believer from the ups and downs of what's happening, because there's an understanding that everything is working out the way it's supposed to be working out. We don't have to judge the good and the bad and the good and the bad, because it's all ultimately going to unfold. Ultimately, all that is false, all that is destructive, all that is negative will just fall away, because it's all illusory anyway. Eventually, it'll all fall away. But the deeper underlying message here is that ultimate place that the mind can imagine is in the future is actually the consciousness itself that's not being dragged around by the good and the bad. In other words, the farmer that isn't being dragged around by the drama of the neighbors, it's he that character has access to an essential goodness that's on a completely different level from the good and the bad of conditions. It's a goodness that is just inherent in being, which we all have access to at every moment once we free ourselves, once we make that decision to drop giving importance to how the mind wants to judge things. So like you said, maybe not, right? So allowing yourself to sink into this unknowing, allowing the mind to not have something to grab onto, to not be able to really judge in any kind of ultimate way. In relative ways, day to day, of course, we make decisions, we have to judge things, make judgments all the time.
Right.
But in the big sense, to carry around with us the burden of having a particular judgment on things, a particular point of view, the burden of the burden of resistance, basically, the burden of resisting how it is, and how it is, and how it's constantly becoming. The world, Olam Haba, right, which is an expression in Judaism, it's an expression that means the messianic era. It's the future, Olam Haba. But really it means the world that's coming. And the world that's coming, of course, is actually this world. This world is constantly becoming. And as it becomes, good things are happening and bad things are happening. But the world itself is beyond that. The world itself is on a completely different level. The world itself is just this existence, this beingness. So Olam Haba is Mashiach is synonymous with salvation. So if you want salvation, if you want real salvation, then don't be dragged around by the conditions of the world. The conditions of experience. So,
I've been thinking, like, if everything is like a divine plan or the divine behind the scene and the free will that humans have, it is just the will of God. Mm-hmm. There's no free will. Mm-hmm. And if you want to have that free will, you would say whatever you want from me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's something that for me at the end of the day was my own conclusion. It's like, no, it seems like we don't have that free will, because at the end of the day things that will, it's his will.
So does that thought for you, is that a liberating thought for you?
You from the mind?
Yeah.
No. Because comes the dualistic part, like, then I do not have free choice or
power. Right, exactly. Right.
But from the heart and the surrendering part, it's like,
yeah. Right.
I'm here.
Right.
So,
right.
I'm just a vehicle of whatever plan and whatever you're orchestrating behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm. These ideas of free will, of not free will, right, are mental ideas.
Yeah.
Right? They're mental constructs.
Mm-hmm.
So they're either helpful or they're not helpful. And like you said it beautifully, if you're getting into it as a mental argument, then it's not helpful.
Yeah.
But if you're allowing that to be an opening for the heart, so that if that idea of no free will is functioning the right way for you, then it can be very liberating. Yeah. But it's not a philosophical argument. It has nothing to do with, is there really free will, is there not free will? It's nothing to do with that. It has to do with, I mean, as a, if it's going to be useful spiritually.
Yeah.
Right?
Your own experience. And
yeah.
The
and
things,
it's all, it's
yeah.
about
mm-hmm.
whether you're surrendered or not.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're surrendered or not. But then there's an aspect of free will that's very important to embrace, which is that it's your choice in this moment. And every moment, it's your choice to surrender or not.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's very empowering. So then the free will idea of having free will can be very useful. You know, in rabbinic Judaism, there's an idea that we have paradoxical concepts that we need to have opposite ideas in each pocket. And we have to pull out the right idea at the right time to serve us. So in one pocket it says, the world was created for my sake. And in the other pocket it says, I'm just dust and ashes. So sometimes you need to see one, sometimes you need to see the other, depending on which way your mind is trying to drag you. And by the mind dragging you, I mean that the mind is trying to solidify into a certain point of view, into a certain belief that makes you feel like you have some kind of control. Some kind of control by having a certain grasp, a certain understanding, by putting things in a certain box. We can know what's okay and what's not okay.
I saw a very good movie last week called Nebraska, and it's about an old man who is perhaps senile, but he's way up in years, and he has this belief that he's won the lottery and has to go to Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, to collect $1 million. And he lives in Billings, Montana, and he's walking, and the police pick him up and take him home repeatedly. So his youngest son decides they're going to drive to Nebraska. He's going to be with his father, and they're going to go through this trip. And he expects that his father will find out that it's a scam, that he hasn't won anything. Mm. In any case, it's the son staying with the father on this odyssey.
Right.
And
don't tell us the ending.
No, I won't tell you. Okay. But what brought it to mind was when you talked about the idea or the concept of everything will turn out right. Mm. These people have had hard lives. Mm-hmm. You know, they're hard-scrabble folk.
Right. And
the old man believes, and the son thinks, all right, I love my dad. I'm not going to humiliate him. I'm going to go on this odyssey.
Right.
And he'll find that.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't tell you.
I just heard an interview, and it sounded really good.
What's it called?
Nebraska.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, I have heard of that, too.
Yeah,
so, and of course, well, I don't know. I haven't seen the movie, but I'll bet that the important thing about the movie is the journey,
As I was watching the movie, I just thought of Kivud of Va'im, and
the son is
trying to help his father, or be with his father,
right,
or accompany him on this last stage of his life, which is, at least from a Jewish point of view, very honorable.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's another beautiful lesson in that too, which is that from the son's point of view, this is a fictitious thing. This isn't worthwhile to go to try to collect this money. Mm-hmm. And yet, so the point of view of the father to the son is kind of crazy. It's wrong. It's illusory, right? And yet, the son is able to be present with that illusory point of view and be with it and not just reject it and push it out the window. So it's the same thing with our minds. You know, our minds are prone towards illusory, very, very partial, very flimsily put together ideas about things that we can then get sucked into, and our emotions can get pulled around by, and so on. But the solution is not to repress that or to reject that or to push it, try to push it away from us.
Right.
Just the opposite. The solution is to really look at it and to really allow it, really allow yourself to see it and to feel it. Because if you're trying to push it away, you're trying to get rid of it, then you're just in another of the same dynamic. You're just in another of the same prison. You're just, once again, trying to get to some other state. I have this crazy mind that's doing these crazy things, and I want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's just more of the same crazy mind. Trying to get somewhere, trying to believe that the promised land is just over the hill. But Mashiach is coming means don't worry about it. Be with the process. Be on the journey. Be fully on the journey. Trust where it's going. Where it's going is incomprehensible. We can never really know where it's going, so let's just call it Mashiach. But the only solution, the only thing that's really sane, is to fully open to where we are on the journey in this moment.
So it's not so much what we do that'll affect that, except that it is.
That'll affect what?
What's happening isn't so much like ego to think that we could change that, but on the other hand, you want to be, you want to be of service to God. You want to bring out the sparks of good into the world.
Right.
You want to have Messianic age come sooner.
Right.
You want to hurry it along. You want to have your life mean something.
Mm-hmm.
That way. But also you don't, because it's not like you want to just say, oh, it doesn't matter then what I do.
Mm.
But
it doesn't matter what I do is, again, taking a certain idea. That's a mental idea. Doesn't matter what I do, or it really matters what I do, Sometimes one idea is more useful than the other, and sometimes, whichever idea is useful, can change back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But both of them are just, again, both of them are just ideas that are trying to grasp and mediate between us and reality.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need to do that, actually. You don't need to mediate between yourself and reality. Just be with reality. Just live fully without the mind trying to grasp it and understand it. Trying to say that it matters or it doesn't matter, right? That's the mind getting in between you and reality and trying to make the right judgment on it, trying to put it in the right box. But if there's this goodness that is what you are, which is true, right? Which is what you are. There's the underneath the mental understanding, underneath the mental judgments, right? It's benevolent. It's benevolent the way it wants to express itself. It's goodness. Why wouldn't it be? Right? The whole future is born out of this moment. Right, so that's another part of the full embracing of this moment, is to know that whatever's coming in the future is born, it's born out of this moment. So if we want goodness in some future, at some future time, which is logical to want good things, but whatever is going to come is born out of what we're giving now.
Creating good karma.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything and all the karma of right now was created before. So we have maybe some bad karma today. maybe certain things happened today that were not so fun, not so nice. That were stressful. That weren't working. Heartbreaking. Creates fear. Creates terror. Whatever it is. That's all created. That's all stuff that was conditioned from the past and has come to fruition today. But still, our choice is always the same. Still, we either fully open to it, and from this openness is born positivity, or we are resisting it because we don't like it, which is natural. Right? We don't like it, so it's natural to resist it. But then we create more of it. That's the only thing. But if we open to it, it also means we feel it more. So it means we feel the pain more. When we open more, we feel the pain more. But that's the symbolism of the Israelites in Egypt, feeling the pain of Egypt, feeling the pain of Mitzrayim, or in Christianity, the Jesus on the cross. Or in the, you know, the nature myths, the princess that's dragged down for the winter.
The descent to Nala.
Yeah.
Persephone.
Persephone, Carissa, Inanna, and Samaria, it's the same. So I have a question about the Messianic age. I find I'm concerned about that because the way we're living now would seem like the Messianic age to the Jews in the concentration camp or the Jews that were slaves in Egypt, thinking about walking freely as a Jew. In Berkeley, there's like, 10 different ways we can observe as Jews, and we can walk into any congregation of any faith and say, hello, here I am. And, you know, so when I think about it, it's up for interpretation. I mean, I'm obviously not a biblical scholar, but every story I've ever heard, we're doing better than they were. And yet we're still struggling. So when I think about that perception of what does that mean, the Messianic age, I mean, when we think, if we could only be out of this pain, it would be so wonderful. But here we are out of that horrible pain.
Right.
But we're still living in a world where people are killing each other and destroying the earth. So
right. There's
a, it seems like another one of those concepts that is more symbolic than literal, because what does that mean, the Messiah comes? Maybe that's enlightenment. Maybe it's my death when I realize I all the work I've done in my whole life is leading me to being a free soul. Maybe that's when the Messiah comes. I mean, it's my fantasy that right after I die it all makes sense, at least for a moment. But
yeah, it's about to ask the same life to death.
So I wonder about that. I wonder about what is how literally to take that whole idea.
Well, there's the idea that as it exists in the Jewish spiritual tradition, and then there's what function it has for us.
Yes.
Individually. No. I mean, in Judaism, in the Hasidic tradition that I'm familiar with, all those things that you said are all part of one continuum, one process, I should say. So what happens on the individual level also happens on the collective level. And from the point of view of the soul, death is a kind of Mashiach, because it's a release of the soul from the bonds of physicality that drag us around, that drag us into this suffering of life. So that's true. But in the idea of a messianic era means that the psycho-spiritual conditions that create the inner resistance that we as human beings have, which gives rise to the negative qualities, to the qualities that are that we perceive to be the opposite of holiness and of goodness, aggression and anger and fear and, you know, the all the qualities of ego, that all those things will dissolve in humanity. So that's the idea of that Messiah, is that it's just like it's just a removal of the veil.
Yes.
And that which takes effort now to remind ourselves and to consciously choose to let go, right, will become obvious in the future. But, you know, all those are ideas, those are part of the map of the system of Hasidism, of Hasidic thought, and so on. Not necessarily so consequential one way or the other. The real choice for us is something that's much more energetic than a belief in the mind. Now, I see it as what we were talking about earlier. The mental idea of Mashiach in the future can be useful if it serves for us to energetically open ourselves to the future. Right? It's a remedy. It's a remedy for the tendency to think that what's coming up is something we have to shrink away from, something negative, something we're afraid of. You know, I saw on one of these science shows that my son likes to watch sometimes, maybe it was like a Stephen Hawking show or something, talking about that the universe ends eventually, either in the Big Rip, which means it just kind of the universe expands so much that all matter kind of just rips apart and nothing, and there's no cohesion to anything anymore. And the whole universe just becomes non-functional. Like all the atoms just fly apart from each other eventually. Or there's something called the Big Crunch, which it reaches like a certain amount and then it all just reverses and comes back to the single point of the Big Bang again. And neither one of those feels very reassuring, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like
it's probably going to be slow and subtle.
Well, it's going to be slow and subtle, but whatever it is, it's annihilation. Right?
Yes.
It's either way, it's complete annihilation of everything. So all that, so much of our motivation that's based on our mind and our ego is about like what's going to last, what's going to preserve, what's going to, you know. And you can think of just in the Jewish world too, there's all this energy around the survival of the Jewish people, and, you know, the numbers, you know, how many people are identifying and interacting. Like, there's all this energy around it as if all that means something, you know, and it's like, well, what do you, there's no understanding of actually where we're going toward, because we don't know where we're going toward, and according to science, we're going towards annihilation ultimately. So those are all things that if we really confront them, can cause us to exist in a world, in a nightmare world of anxiety and negativity, or a world of believing, like you said, believing, oh, well, it doesn't matter anyway, it's all for naught. This kind of absurdist kind of point of view. But all that is energetic, and all of that is based on mental understanding. You know, understanding of the Big Rip and the Big Crunch in the future, that's all just mental ideas of a thing that we actually have no idea what it really is. We really don't know. We can understand things about physics, but what is physics? What is the universe? All that is ultimately just total mystery. It's totally beyond, and always will be beyond, the mind to understand. And so from a spiritual point of view, what's really important is, how are we energetically relating to this moment?
So doesn't it bring us right back to the free will, or the idea of how do I want to be walking on this earth? How do I want to be? You know, if we're going to be all saved, everything's going to be wonderful, if it's all going to get destroyed, does that mean I'm not going to take care of people? I'm not going to take care of the earth? Because it, you know, 10 million years after I die, something horrible is going to happen. It's, you know.
Right.
So it still comes back to where we are right now, and,
right.
and are we walking respectfully on our earth,
right.
and with our people?
Right. Right.
And yes, there's a lot of nervousness about, we better do it now because we're kind of destroying everything. That might be speeding things up. But maybe you're suggesting that we do it anyway, but without the nervous energy, like, you know.
Well, right. Do we want the nervous energy?
Well, not really. But I also want people to be scared enough that they're going to, like, not destroy our earth right now. We're not going to dump toxic things into the water and kill all the fish. Only because it's not, you know, like a kind thing to do to the creatures that live in the water, not because, oh my God, we're going to die tomorrow. But it seems that that motivates us.
Well, it could. Yeah, there's...
Like that global warming threat's helping people, like, do the right thing.
Maybe,
so,
maybe. Some people.
Right. So...
It's called
maybe
the lower...
It's good, maybe it's bad, no.
In the Tanya, it's called the lower level of fear.
Right.
You know, it's like the lowest level of motivation is fear of the bad thing that's going to happen. Mm. Right?
But sometimes, I guess,
oh, it's not
humans, we need that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, children.
You don't have that.
You know,
you're really in trouble.
Sometimes you have to resort to that.
Yeah.
But again, this is all kind of theoretical, talking about what people need to motivate them, you know. But the real question is, how are we relating to this moment? Not the real question isn't how do we take care of how the big corporations are going to be afraid of what they're doing. I mean, that's a task. That is something to concern oneself with, but that's not the spiritual question for ourselves at this moment. That's a theoretical question that we can do our best with it, but we ultimately have no control over that. But do we need to be afraid of the bad things that are going to happen for us in order to take this moment seriously? We do believe that unconsciously a lot. I mean, otherwise, why would you ever become anxious or take on nervous energy? We unconsciously believe that we have to make ourselves feel bad in order to motivate ourselves. We do it all the time. It's a constant neurotic compulsion that we do all the time. We think, oh God, I can't believe I shouldn't have done that, or I shouldn't have, you know. Why? Because we think that by getting angry or something, that somehow that's going to change things for the better.
Or that it's doing penance.
Or that's doing penance, right. We're punishing ourselves, right.
Right.
Yeah. Punishing ourselves, right. So we exist on all these different levels.
Well, it's the way we've been, at least the way I was trained since I was as small as I can remember.
That's right. But what's good to see is that we do it unconsciously. We do it unconsciously. And so what happens when we begin to examine it, when we begin to look carefully, slowly, like under a microscope, at how we are functioning moment to moment, the choices that we're making, the inner choices that we're making moment to moment, then something really powerful can happen, something really deep, something really transformative. When you really see what's going on, when you really see what your thoughts do, and what your choice is to have those thoughts or to entertain them. That's life-changing. And it's not theoretical.